Talk to us now and go to the TNT Radio Interactive Live chat room at tntradio.live. Lighting the fuse for freedom. Today's News Talk Radio, TNT. This is the Freeman Report on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Welcome back with me, James Freeman. This is the Freeman Report, and it is Monday, the 30th of January. Now, if you've just joined me, I had Ben Habib, an old colleague of mine from the European Parliament, on in the first hour. If you've missed the show, don't worry. You can sign on onto the tntradio.live website tomorrow. Just go to shows and you'll be able to listen back to that interview, which was a really fascinating interview. We talked about everything from CBDCs to net zero, a little bit about Brexit and the UK political system. Right. Okay. Next up, I have Jim Ferguson. So Jim is a businessman, an entrepreneur, and a former parliamentary candidate for the Brexit Party. We'll be talking about why he got involved in politics and what is wrong at the heart of the British political system. We'll also be talking about Reform UK and if it is the alternative that the UK desperately needs. Talking a little bit about British farming, and also the terrible policies inflicted on all of us over the last 3 years. Right, now, what is wrong with the British political system? Everybody knows there's a problem, and we've been talking about it for what seems like an eternity. Yes, we have interference from entities like the World Economic Forum, but there are also structural reasons that explain why we get the politicians we do. And I believe one of the major factors is our broken electoral system. A sizable proportion of the electorate do not vote for the party they want. They instead vote to keep out the party they don't want. It's why the Tories spend so much time telling you what a mess Labour would make of the country, instead of saying what they would do to make the country better. And Labour are the same, telling us that the Tories will privatise and destroy the NHS, when in fact, most of the biggest moves towards privatisation happened under the Blair government. Both parties do this because they know it works. And it does work in our first-past-the-post system. Most people end up so frightened of the other party getting in that they vote for the party that they don't really believe in. Now, there are people who do vote for the party they believe in, but because we have this first-past-the-post system, their votes mostly don't count. And then, of course, there's the non-voters who know about everything I'm talking about, and they've given up on the whole system. They know their vote won't count, so they don't even bother to register it. So how do we fix this? Well, I think the UK at some point has to introduce some form of proportional system. Personally, I would go with a fully proportional system. Now, look, I know there's pros and cons to this, like how do you vote for a person under a proportional system? And also the fact that we'd be more likely to get lots of coalition governments where nobody gets exactly what they want. However, my question is, what is the alternative? Because carrying on with this broken system is running the country into the ground. So, in addition to getting rid of the influence of the World Economic Forum, I think we also need to fix our broken electoral system. Right, now, don't miss out on a thing. Be sure to download the TNT Radio app from either the Apple App Store or the Google Play Store. You'll then be able to listen live to us anywhere at any time, and it's available right now. Okay, so stick around with me because in a moment I'll be joined by Dee Dee Denslow to talk about one of the big stories of the day. My name's James Freeman, and this is the Freeman Report on TNT Radio.
Real political talk.
Party politics is killing our government.
Today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Americans warned of financial catastrophe. Now, I find this headline a bit bemusing because over the last few days, we've heard several times from the Bank of England that the recession isn't going to be as deep or as long as we thought. And yet we get this headline. What's this all about, Darren?
It depends on which media outlet that we're reporting from. This particular article is actually from RT, and the US states the US Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen on Saturday warned of dire consequences the country may be facing if it doesn't hike its statutory debt ceiling in the coming months. According to the senior official, the US could default on its debt by summer, which would lead to a financial crisis. Now, we hear this story quite a lot coming out of the USA about their debt ceiling. It makes me nervous. It would be devastating. It's a catastrophe, Yellen told Axios news outlet, adding that we'll have a financial crisis and I believe we would have a recession in the United States. Spending would have to decline to match the tax revenues, Yellen said, which would strip the government of the ability to support the economy with stimulus. Furthermore, psychological consequences like people fearing to spend money could then further impact spending and deepen a recession. She noted that a full-blown US debt default would also send ripple effects across the global economy. And actually, that's why I chose this particular story, because everything sort of, particularly in the UK, is like 6 months downstream from whatever is going on across the pond. Americans would face higher borrowing costs and it would cause a good deal of turmoil globally as well, Yellen said. The secretary began to raise alarm on potential US debt default early this month, notifying the US Congress that the Treasury has started to invoke emergency measures to prevent the country from reaching a debt ceiling, which is now set at just a minor $31.4 trillion. The measures largely involve temporary suspending payments that are not immediately necessary to keep the government running. Yellen noted at the time, however, that the measures could only go as far as give Congress time to negotiate and pass a debt limit hike, most likely until early June. Without the hike, default would be imminent. So the Americans love to put everything on a tab, by the looks of it. Their debt ceiling at $31.4 trillion is almost 10 times that of the UK. However, if they don't increase that debt ceiling, then it would mean that they have almost no money to spend because, like I just said, the US live on a tick bill. As we say at street level, they're on tick, which means also that they're on borrow time, James.
Yeah, there's a few things to say about this. I mean, look, you know, the debt ceiling that they put in place, I really don't understand why. It seems to be a recurring thing that happens in all presidencies. We had the same wranglings with Trump and also with Barack Obama. I was just getting a name block there. You know, and when you look at inflation at the moment, what you've got to realize is debt is money. If you cancelled all of the debt that existed in the UK, there wouldn't be any money. And I don't think that a lot of people understand this. And when you've got rampant inflation like we have at the moment, that debt ceiling is going to increase. Now, I am worried about this, and I've been worried about the potential for a huge recession over the last 18 months. And, you know, whether it's, you know, these talks about the wrangling over the debt ceiling and access to funds in the US, you know, I think there's much bigger things actually that are threats to the US economy. Like, for example, the fact that Russia, China, Brazil, the BRICS countries and other countries as well are trying to create a world reserve currency to compete with the dollar. Now, the reason the US economy is so big and the fact that their military is, well, I mean, I think I heard a statistic today that you can put the next six militaries together and they're still not as big as the US military. Yeah. Now, the reason the US are able to fund all of that and also be the super economy that they are is because the dollar is the reserve currency. Because essentially, if you are Brazil, China, Russia at the moment, if you want to buy energy globally, whether that's gas or oil, you have to buy the dollars first. And of course, what are dollars? They're just paper. They're just made up money. So when all of these countries go to the US and they say, right, okay, we need to buy some oil, can we please have some dollars? They actually have to buy those, and they're just made up. So what actually the result of that is we end up with a hugely inflated US economy. Now, what do you think is going to happen when, you know, all these countries create another world reserve currency and people don't have to buy dollars anymore? Well, I don't think it takes a mathematician to work out what could happen next. And it could be incredibly damaging to the US economy. So there are many reasons to be worried about the global economy, because, of course, you know, what happens in the US, we're not exempt from that. Anything that happens in the US will happen to us as well, which is why I'm very confused that the Bank of England has been coming out not just once, but several times over the last few weeks saying, we don't need to worry now. You know, after all the shenanigans before Christmas last year to get rid of Liz Truss, when, you know, oh my God, the insurance markets were in chaos and we were on, you know, the pound was tanking and we were on the verge of a disaster. For the Bank of England now to come back and say, yeah, do you know what? It's not that bad after all. I find incredible when these world events are going on. What are your thoughts, Darren?
I mean, you mentioned BRICS. I mean, some of these countries have a lot of WEF influence in them, but the currency that the Russians and they're talking about China and India and Brazil and South Africa that they're trying to put in place, and the Saudi Arabians are going, oh, we quite like this idea of an alternative currency because we're not really that interested in the dollar anymore, especially with Biden in charge. That alternative currency is very likely to be backed up by real value, things like gold, rare metals, and rare resources. The dollar's not backed up by anything. If people move away and start eyeing up this BRICS alternative currency or alternative currencies, there's a lot of you know, there's the Bitcoin and cryptos as well. Then people are going to be sat on these piles of dollars. Paper dollars, metaphorically speaking, they're going to send them all back to the USA. And all of a sudden, every single one of those dollars is a debt. And that leaves the USA with serious issues because they can't pay this debt. There's no debt. There's no money to pay it with. There's no anything of real value to pay it with. And all they'll be left with is a military. And I believe a country that's facing massive economic issues with a massive military makes them dangerous. And we just heard at the beginning about, oh, there's going to be a war with China in 24 months' time. I believe that's a real, real, almost certain prospect, particularly as the Americans will have nothing but their military. So I'm not going on a bit of a tangent there. I'm just sort of trying to predict, look in my crystal ball, what's coming down line in 24 months, 5 years' time. I think we'll see that the Americans are in a conflict as they try to defend their hegemony and their rule over the planet with the only thing that they have left, and that's firepower. And I think that's quite scary.
Yeah, it certainly is. And this is something I will continue to talk about on the show over the coming weeks. Right, Darren, well, thank you very much for joining me today. You're back on at 1 again?
Yeah, I am on at 1 p.m., 3 p.m. this week. I keep saying it's my final week. It might be. I don't know. However, I have got Tim Gill, who I met in Kegworth this weekend. He is an ex-military guy, close protection officer, and runs camping festivals for the Awake. So I'll be speaking to him. And then I've got regular guests, Dr. Kat Linley, afterwards. We'll be talking about the trans issue in Scotland and COVID and Project Veritas. So please stay with me on TNT. I'll be here on Digging Deeper at 1 p.m. today.
Yeah, fantastic. And we've got a number of good shows lined up today. So, but it's not over yet on the Freeman Report. So thank you, Darren. I'll speak to you tomorrow. So yeah, we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, I'll be speaking with Jim Ferguson.
The
TNT Radio's Steve Hook.
There's going to be a video released. Everybody's a little bit worried about this because this is the video of Tyree Nichols getting beaten to death by five police officers in Memphis. And, well, he didn't die on the scene, but he died 3 days later. All of the officers involved were black police officers. Tyree Nichols was a black young man, about 29 years old. The country is on a kind of on a knife's edge here as we wait for this body cam footage to be released. And here's hoping that cooler heads prevail and that we genuinely see peaceful protest as opposed to rioting. I know in the city of Atlanta, Governor Brian Kemp has already called out the National Guard just to be on standby and to be in place. I hear in Memphis that they've got police basically all over the city, some undercover, some on horseback. And we all just wait and see what happens. And, well, like I said, hopefully cooler heads will prevail.
Steve Hook on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
This is a message for the parents of young children in the United States. I am Dr. Tess Lorry from the World Council for Health. Please consider the danger of vaccinating your children and babies with the COVID-19 injections. They are not the same as traditional vaccines and are causing significant harm to children around the world. Your children have their whole lives ahead of them. They are not endangered by COVID at all. Please hear us when we say, for your children, it is much safer to wait. Thank you.
A cashless society means zero cash. 100% digital currency means your life is 100% dependent on a power surge and the internet. Every cent you receive will be recorded and every transaction tracked. Lighting the fuse for freedom. TNT Radio.
Welcome back. It's Monday, the 30th of January. My name's James Freeman, and this is the Freeman Report. Right, next up, I have Jim Ferguson on the line. So Jim is a businessman, an entrepreneur, and also a former parliamentary candidate for the Brexit Party. Hello, Jim.
Good morning, James. Thank you for having me on.
No, thank you for joining me. I guess the first obvious question is, you know, we both sort of got involved in politics around the Brexit vote. But what was it about that that actually made you say, do you know what, I've got to actually get up off my ass and do something? What was it that motivated you?
Well, I think probably one of the main things that motivated me, James, was the fact that I was... I was sitting at home, the news bulletin came on, and what happened was that news came on, Nigel Farage speaking about the formation of a new Brexit party. And that really led me into thinking, right, okay, there's something to this. And I'd watched Nigel speaking in the European Parliament for a long period of time. Always thought he was a really good orator, a great speaker, and how he used to run circles around people like Juncker and other European commissioners. But something within me, I pondered it for most of that afternoon, and then I thought, I'm going to go down to the launch in the steel factory in Coventry. And I did. It was one of the first there, got through security, was ushered in and specifically told to sit on the stage, which I thought was a bit strange. But I did as I was told. And lo and behold, I ended up being a couple of rows just behind Nigel. When all the cameras came in, of course, they're pointing at me. I started getting some communication saying, is that you on stage with Nigel? What's going on? Yes, it was me. And I ended up then speaking to somebody who was quite senior within the party, who asked me about my background, what I did, and then invited me for another conversation with him and some others. And then after that happened, I was asked if I would be prepared to stand in the European elections, which I agreed to do.
Yeah, and thank God you did, and people like me as well, and lots of others around the country did. Normal people, you know, got up and thought, do you know what? Our politicians are letting us down and I've got to do something about it. I'll just make one comment about, because I watched Nigel. I mean, I didn't follow Nigel when he was in UKIP. I wasn't really that interested in politics at the time. But I do remember over the Brexit period when I was so frustrated with what was going on in the UK. I do remember watching so many of Nigel's speeches in the EU Parliament. And I can tell you what, the first time that I was actually sat behind him, I had hairs on the back of my neck, stood up, and it really was something else to actually go within the space of 2 months to working as a civil servant for the UK government, to then being sat behind Nigel Farage in the EU Parliament. That was one hell of a journey. Right. Okay. One of the things I think that the Brexit Party did, and there was always this misunderstanding that the Brexit Party was on, you know, far right and all of this. And actually, when you actually look at the policies that they had, and also their candidates as well, you know, there were 29 of us that actually got elected and went to the EU Parliament, and they certainly weren't far right. We had a broad spectrum across the right and left of politics. What are your comments on this? And what do you know? Did you think you realised this at the time, Jim? That what you know, the fact that the Brexit Party wasn't far right.
Well, I didn't believe it was far right because I've never thought that Nigel was far right anyway. I mean, the extreme left branded him as such. But what I did think, quite incorrectly, was that the Brexit Party was going to be made up of disaffected Tories with maybe a few handfuls of UKIP people thrown in. And boy, was I wrong. When I joined the party, I remember sitting down for the first time with people that I'd never met and finding out that they were actually from the traditional Labour left. And I had never really spoken to too many people from the left side of things. And initially, it really shocked and surprised me. But I very quickly realized that even going back into the days of Edward Heath, when he took us into the European Economic Community, the traditional Labour Party at that point was vehemently opposed to having further integration with the EU. And I had a huge education in meeting with people who were great people, solid people that were Brexiteers, but they had come from the traditional Labour left, and they were just really wonderful. Now, one of the things that I wanted to highlight was the fact that when you bring moderate left to moderate right together, you have an incredibly powerful dynamic there. So I had a lot of learning to do, but it was one of the best experiences of my entire life. And when I stood as the member of prospective, or the parliamentary candidate in Barnsley East, practically my entire team were from the traditional left. I was probably the only right of centre one there. They were made me welcome. And I mean, I was a Scot in an English city. But it went down very well. They liked me, they flocked to me. And I think out of all the candidates in the party, I and my colleague in Barnsley came closest to actually winning our seats.
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? I think, you know, there was a misconception that the Brexit Party was on the right side, but actually it did get, I mean, certainly here in Wales, I mean, the constituency that I stood in for the UK general election back in 2019, the Labour MP here at the time had 58% of the vote. Now, I managed to get 14%. And guess what? His vote went from 58 down to 44%. The Tories stayed exactly where they were. So, you know, I think there was a big misconception about the Brexit Party. And like I said, all you need to do really is stop reading the headlines and actually look at the policies that they had and also the candidates that they had in the party. Right now, obviously, the Brexit Party has now become Reform UK. First of all, before we start talking about Reform UK, I'd love to hear what your thoughts are in terms of how that transition went. Do you think that that was done in the best way that it could have been?
Probably not. I mean, I actually didn't transfer over to Reform, which has surprised a lot of people because I've been quite outspoken about things over the course of the last period of time. And I had other things that I was working on, other projects, and I was a very serious political candidate. And I've always maintained if you're going to be a political candidate or get involved with a party, you've got to give it 110%, which is what I did. I mean, in the European elections where I stood as the candidate for the European Parliament, I was number three on the list. But I ended up doing an awful lot more because number one and number two didn't want to go and do live hustings events. They didn't feel confident going in front of televised audiences where they were answering questions, but it didn't really bother me. I was quite happy to be in front of a camera. So I got sucked into doing an awful lot more within the Brexit Party, and the amount of work that was done there, along with others, in building that strong foundation, I feel didn't really get carried across. And of course, I've been fairly outspoken about the direction of reform, but I think it's not done as a way to negate anything that Reform UK is as a party, because I actually think they must be a credible party in time for the general election. My criticisms were levied at other areas, which we can certainly discuss. But I think that there certainly could have been a better transfer across. And I know many candidates, many of them actually, who I interviewed and helped to recruit and vet within the party, within the Brexit party, who felt that they hadn't been contacted by senior party officials to even to thank them for the work that they had done, for certainly for those of us who got to stand and fight in the political front lines.
Yeah, for me, I mean, I remember getting very, very frustrated after the general election, because there seemed to be a period of about a year where we were still the Brexit party. Nigel Farage was still the head of the party, but there was nothing going on. And I think that left a void. And a lot of the people who supported us over Brexit just started to drift off and lose. They had become disillusioned with the fact that the party weren't actually doing anything. And then, of course, literally 3 months before the Welsh elections back in 2021, the party rebranded to Reform UK. Nigel, I mean, he's still an honorary, I forget the exact title, he's a grandee of the party, but essentially he stepped down from day-to-day running of the party, and Richard Tice is now the leader. And we did awful. I mean, you know, given the fact that I had 14% in the general election, I think I got less than 1%, or it was around 1% under Reform UK in the Welsh election. So it was and I did become very, very disillusioned with the party. Now, okay, so we've got Reform UK now under Richard Tice. What are your thoughts on, in fact, actually, we'll take a quick break, Jim. And when we come back, I want to know your thoughts on where you think the party is now under Richard Tice.
Well, what's the news?
TNT Radio News.
Matt Boyland here with a look at your TNT headlines. Former US President Donald Trump has taken aim at Joe Biden at a rally in South Carolina, accusing the 80-year-old of pushing the world closer to war. A top US general has praised last year's attack on Russia's Nord Stream gas pipelines, saying Washington was very pleased to hear of the outcome. And Jerusalem has been rocked by two separate shooting attacks, including one committed by a 13-year-old boy.
At TNT Radio, we never go home. We're committed to bringing you our take on the biggest topics of our time. We're on air 24/7 online globally, no matter what. We've got you covered on TNT Radio.
Welcome back with me, James Freeman. This is the Freeman Report. And on the line, I've got Jim Ferguson. Now, before the break, we were talking about the Brexit Party and its change into and rebranding into Reform UK. And I want to hear from Jim what he thinks of where Reform UK is now under its new leader, Richard Tice.
Well, I think, in fairness to Mr. Tice, Nigel Farage is a very hard act to follow. He's incredibly charismatic and was very popular within the movement, not just within the Brexit Party, but within the Brexit movement itself. And, you know, when somebody of that charismatic leadership hands over the reins to somebody else and endorses that person, there's going to be a period of time where the party faithful and general members of the public are going to lend their support and loyalty to that new leader. But one thing that has become apparent was the whole Andrew Bridgen saga that blew up about a week ago. And I'm sure everybody knows, you know, Andrew Bridgen is a Conservative Member of Parliament who wanted to go in and raise, which I felt was very, very important issues about the vaccination using mRNA technology of children as young as 6 months. So we're talking about babies in effect. And I believe, you know, Richard took a very sort of strong Andrew Bridgen position, which I felt was rather arrogant and really quite ignorant of him to do that. Well, that really blew up on the Friday night. I mean, that just took off. And then it happened again on the Monday evening. And the amount of comments, we're talking not just thousands, we're talking tens of thousands of people absolutely roasting Richard Tice. And I went back through, James, and I looked through the comments. Now, I tried to do a bit of analysis on it and tried to sort of set aside some of the data to look at how many people were supporting Richard Tice in this and how many people were against him. And it was just unbelievably overwhelming against Richard Tice. And it one thing that it certainly exposed, because Andrew Bridgen is one thing, and I don't think we all need to get too much caught up in it, but I think it is important, especially with things that he has said, which I've been listening and paying very close attention to. But one thing about Richard Tice and the leadership of Reform UK that it seems to have exposed very, very much is the fact that it looks like there has been a long-seated, long-term mistrust and unpopularity of Richard Tice as the leader. And one thing that I noted was that there were very few comments of support coming in from Reform Party candidates or the heavyweights within the Reform Party itself. He seemed to be very much on his own. And over the course of that week, I was contacted by people who are currently Reform Party candidates, many of whom I know personally, and some who I actually interviewed and brought into the party. So they're very, very decent people. They're good people. And some of them were saying, look, we just don't agree with this. What do you think I should do? And I said, well, I'm not even a member of Reform UK. I can't give you advice, but I would suggest that you hold fire till we see what happens. But I think that popularity has waned drastically. And as you said about Wales, you know, there's been a long period of time where there was just nothing happening. And my concern is this. We may have the last real opportunity to mount an effective challenge to both Labour and the Conservatives, because the first-past-the-post system's a tough nut to crack. We've got to mobilise. We've got to get organised. And my concern is leaving Richard Tice in to run the Reform Party could, and certainly I believe has, resulted in a loss of public trust. It caused an alienation of key voters and also members of the party itself. And quite frankly, we can't afford to let that fester for much longer. And this isn't going to go away. That massive upset has really caused a lot of people to go, wait a minute, I like the Brexit Party, but under Tice, I don't think I can support them. I mean, the comments, they're in their hundreds and thousands of comments that have come in, James.
Yeah, and just for anybody who's not aware what actually happened and what brought all this on, Andrew Bridgen, who's a Conservative MP, well, he was a Conservative MP in the UK, had the whip taken away from him because of comments he was making about the vaccine. So he's been raising awareness of the damage being done by the vaccines. Now, Richard Tice was, I think it was on LBC, being interviewed, and he was asked, you know, given that Andrew Bridgen has had the whip taken away, would he be welcome in Reform UK? And Richard Tice, you know, if he wasn't interested, he could have said many things. He could have said no comment. He could have said, well, do you know what? I don't talk about hypotheticals. This isn't on the card, so I'm not going to sit here and talk about it. But he didn't do that. He chose to use Andrew Bridgen for political reasons. I can't think of any other reason why. And basically, he said that Andrew Bridgen would not be welcome in Reform UK. Now, since then, Tice has tried to twist the argument around, and he's actually saying now that the reason he said that is because he thinks that people should have a choice, and that Andrew Bridgen is actually calling for the end of the vaccine rollout. Personally, I think that sounds very, very like a way of trying to wriggle his way out of it. And I'm really, really disappointed. I mean, I've been disillusioned with Reform UK for a long time. I stood in the Welsh elections back in 2021, and I had a lot to do with the running of that campaign, along with the other few key candidates. And we built up an infrastructure. We had 40 candidates, a full slate of candidates. A lot of the other parties didn't get that, the smaller parties. So we did an amazing job in pulling all that together. And then what happened after the election? Well, it was left to fall apart. No emails, not one email even thanking the candidates. It was all left to fall apart. And then what really irked me is later that year, I heard Richard Tice on the radio talking about how they're building a local infrastructure to fight the next election. And I just knew that that was not true. And at that point, that was the point where I just knew the Reform UK is never, ever going to get an MP. Now, the other thing to point out here, which I think is really important, is the whole point of having Reform UK or any political party is to get elected members of parliament. And Andrew Bridgen, I'm sure, would have come across to Reform UK. So as well as kind of exposing this lack of political nous in terms of attacking Andrew Bridgen, who was actually been trying to raise important issues, not only as he shot himself in the foot, but actually it's a huge missed opportunity for Reform UK because they could have had an MP in the House of Commons. Right. Okay. That's it. I've said it. That is all I've got to say on that. I don't want to spend any more time on that. Okay. So, Jim, you're an entrepreneur. I know one of the areas that you're sort of moved into in recent years is farming. So tell us a little bit about the kind of farming that you do and some of the challenges at the moment.
Well, I'm quite small scale to some of the bigger farmers. And of course, there's an awful lot of pressure on the farming industry at the moment. I mean, we are producing food, which leads into discussions about things like national security, which a lot of people don't realize and why it's so important. But I mean, you know, cattle, sheep, chickens and crops, you know, bit of a hands-on for everything. But I think that the industry has been under pressure for a long time. It's not been properly supported by consecutive governments, and it's under serious pressure. And I mean, if you take the likes of the cost of fertilizer at the moment, it's not just doubled, it's trebled in price in the last 18 months. And of course, that is, believe it or not, it's not affecting some of the crop guys quite so much, but it's most definitely affecting the guys that are rearing animals for the cost of feed for them. It's just becoming ever more expensive. And I know that there are colleagues of mine within the farming industry who are actually seriously thinking about it. And these are large farms, established farms, multi-generational farms, who are saying, look, we can't do this anymore. We're just not making enough money to live on. And we've got to do something about it, because we've seen a massive falling away in self-sufficiency in food production over the last 30 years by drastic amounts. And we've got to make sure that the national security, energy security, I was listening very carefully to what Ben Habib was to say, saying about this just a little bit before me, but he's right to touch on energy security, because energy security and food security are vital to our nation's national security. And in particular, in light of the things that are happening in the world just now, Ukraine, we just don't know how that's going to blow up. And I'm very concerned to hear about it. And of course, that has also impacted on the fertilizer availability and the amount of increased prices because of its scarcity. So these are issues that we've got to tackle. And there are things that can be done, but I think that we've got to look at more decentralization. I think we've got to look at doing things more at the local level, where that can create more jobs, it can create more opportunities, and it keeps people with that knowledge, that deep understanding of animal husbandry and crops in that particular field. Because if we lose them, you can't really replace that knowledge. It's a very, very difficult thing to do.
It certainly is, Jim. And we're going to take a very, very quick break now. And when we come back, I'd like to talk about some of the other problems in UK farming, which is related to the supermarkets and pricing. So don't go away. We'll be back straight away after this very short break.
You want to eat bugs? How about Bill Gates-funded lab-grown meat, in quotes? Yes, the great food reset has arrived.
From Washington, D.C., this is the Morano Minute with your host, TNT Radio's Mark Morano.
We're saved. The climate is smiling at us. Lab-grown meat harvested in massive steel vats edges closer to federal approval and U.S. dinner plates. Don't worry, the EU is also approving human consumption of worms and crickets. You will eat Bill Gates' lab-grown meat and bugs and be happy. The Climate Agenda Great Reset goal is simple. Collapse modern high-yield agriculture and meat production to meet net zero climate goals. As these shortages and prices skyrocket on meat and other foods, it's much easier to push insect eating and lab-grown meat to the public. It's a culinary future that will happen only if we allow it. It's time for the Great Reject. Don't eat the bugs. This is Mark Morano for the Morano Minute on TNT Radio.
Mama, what does the chicken say? Dog. Cat. Giraffe.
You're not going to get it all right. Just make sure you nail the big stuff, like making sure your kids are buckled correctly in the right seat for their age and size. Get it right.
Visit nhtsa.gov/the right seat.
Brought to you by the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration and the Ad Council.
The Freeman Report on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Welcome back with me, James Freeman. This is the Freeman Report, and I've got Jim Ferguson on the line with me. Now, before the break, we were talking a little bit about farming. Jim has gone into farming recently. We were talking about the pressure that farmers are under in terms of input costs going up. So the cost of fuel, animal feed, nitrogen, and lots of other input costs all rising. But there is also this issue within the UK where the supermarkets are keeping prices down, the amount they're actually giving to farmers. So farmers are getting squeezed, aren't they, Jim?
Yeah, very much so. And I mean, those that, for example, are producing milk are getting pennies, you know, for what they're doing. And if they don't take into account these supermarkets, the cost of the equipment, the time and the labour that it's involved, and the transportation costs, of course, as well, then, of course, that's all been affected by the rising fuel prices and energy prices. So it's all, unfortunately, a bit of a spiralling circle that is, unfortunately, going down the way. And it's putting additional financial pressure on our farming industry and those that produce food. But I think I think it's so important to highlight the fact that, you know, if we were to take a new approach to this, where these supermarkets are really mandated, where they have to give a particular sort of level of income to these food producers and farmers, it would go a long way to stabilizing the industry. Because what we mustn't forget is that things like food poverty has been affected by this, even public health, food sovereignty, and also even things like climate resilience, because a secure food supply helps to make the UK more resilient to the impacts of climate change, but it also provides a stable source of food, even in times of extreme weather like droughts and flooding and other climate-related disruptions to it. But energy security and economic stability plays a massive role in this. And I think what we need to see is a far greater emphasis on supporting those that are in the farming sector. And I think this goes right back even into the education side of things, because so many people don't realize that when they buy a tin of food off the supermarket shelves, they're actually buying last year's produce. And if you don't tackle these issues when they actually arise, you can go for a little period of time where nothing seems to be particularly wrong, but actually it can happen very, very quickly, because that sort of buffer zone can get eaten into very, very, very quickly. And then, of course, we don't know, there can be weather events, there can be all sorts of unknown factors that can impact on things. But just a general degree of stability is what we're wanting to see, and fairness. I mean, these people work very hard. I mean, I'm small scale compared to some, but they're producing a lot of jobs for people, and it's all the interrelated connected industries around it as well that are, of course, being affected.
Yeah, I mean, I just don't understand this. Particularly when you start talking about things like milk, you know, and the very, very small amount that farmers are getting for what is essentially sort of a 4-pint bottle, I'd be more than happy to pay an additional five pence or you know, a few pennies extra, whatever, if that would help farmers. So I really don't understand what the supermarkets are playing at here. Now, I've got a farm shop near here. We do try and buy a lot of our meat from the farm shop. What other ways are you aware of that people can help support their farmers?
Well, encouraging local food production is one of the things that the government could be certainly doing in providing financial support, training and resources to farmers and those that want to invest in new technologies, you know, with the likes of grants that can help food production efficiency, precision agriculture, even things like vertical farming. But I also think that supporting small-scale producers, not just the big farms, but the small-scale producers, is vitally important. You take the crofting community. Crofting is like small-scale farming in the north up in Scotland. And I think that certainly they would be ones to support something like this as well. Promoting sustainable agriculture. I'm a big fan of going back to the old tried and traditional methods of having hedgerows bordering your fields that are using. And in fact, I've written studies on this and given good examples of case studies of why this is so important, because you're providing natural habitats for birds and local insect populations, which then in turn help to pollinate the crops. And those people that provide hedgerows see massive crop yield increases. But also in things like improving trade relations. You know, the UK government could certainly be improving trade relations with other countries to increase access to food imports, whilst also promoting exports of UK-grown food. And of course, reducing waste reduction and looking at new markets. But the other added advantage, and from a healthcare point of view, is promoting healthy diets. I mean, the UK government could certainly be providing more healthy diets by encouraging people to eat more locally grown food and reduce their consumption of processed and imported goods on foods.
Yeah, exactly. So do a Google, see if there's field farms that near you that deliver. One of the resources that I've used here in Wales is actually on the World Council for Health. So if you go to worldcouncilforhealth.org and then you click on the little three lines and you go down, you'll notice something called Source Beta. Now, Source is all about trying to identify local businesses near you that are sustainable and offering you different products. And actually, one of the things they've got on there is UK farms that deliver locally. So if you live in the UK, I would encourage you to go onto the worldcouncilforhealth.org website and visit and sign up to Source. And then you'll be able to do a search in your local area and find farms that are delivering to your door. Now, Jim, the other thing that I think farms are under pressure on is skills, isn't it? I mean, the traditional kind of model is the father runs the farm and then has a son or a daughter and passes on the farm. But I think, you know, I think fewer people are going, are sort of taking on farms these days. So tell me a little bit about your understanding of the pressures coming from this.
Well, I mean, I've come from a long line of farmers. I broke with the tradition, farmers and soldiers. You know, that's my sort of makeup in the past. But the farming industry, they do teach an awful lot of their skills to their sons, their daughters, and the generations that went before them, and that knowledge is passed down. The problem at the moment is because farming is seen as a really fairly hard work, and for not much in the way of profit, people are feeling that they're under pressure to move away. And sons and daughters who might be going to university are not wanting to study agriculture anymore. They want to do other things that might earn a better income for them. And the brain drain, if you like, within British farming at the moment is such to such an extent that if it's not reversed very quickly, just within the next 5 to 10 years, we might be seeing large tracts of land, basically no farming taking place. And that is going to cause a major critical problem for food production and British national security and resilience. Because if we become ever more greater dependent on food imports from foreign nations, while they're friendly, that's fine. And while they're able to provide that source of food and products, that's fine. But what happens? What happens if there's another war? What happens if Ukraine and the situation there suddenly finds it's going out into Poland, Lithuania, Latvia? What happens if it starts to engulf the rest of Europe, or even, God forbid, the entire world? So these are very real probabilities and possibilities that we need to be thinking about right now and not leaving it till it's too late.
Yeah, and definitely. And the other thing that I'd point out as well is, do we really want to outsource the type of food that we're eating? Because, you know, those in the know what Bill Gates and others are up to in terms of processed foods. Essentially, they, you know, Bill Gates has been buying up, I think he's the biggest landowner of farmland in the US now. But, you know, he doesn't want to farm it and grow sustainable crops that can be delivered locally. No. They've got plans. They want to build factories and deliver us all processed foods, which I'm really against. Right. Okay, Jim, we've got about 6 minutes left, and I can't let you go without asking you your views on what's happened over the last 3 years. So I guess firstly, you know, what was your experience of the first lockdown and throughout 2020? And what's your view of the last 3 years now?
Well, I mean, I remember it distinctly coming out from the general election towards the end of 2019 and starting even back then, starting to see reports from China about things that were starting to happen. And I studied the 1918 flu pandemic, more commonly known as the Spanish flu, what happened, what worked and didn't work. And I was horrified to see something on that scale. It was like something out of some kind of dystopian nightmare. I was very concerned about these mandates and these controls that were being put in place. And because the problem is, once governments start to take that degree of power over people, they don't normally like to hand it back. And we've started to see more evidence of that. When they started to look at producing a vaccine, which, by the way, in normal traditional vaccines, and by the way, I'm not a doctor, I'm not a scientist, but I know enough about it to know that it takes about 10 years to produce one. They were producing something within months that wasn't a traditional vaccine. It was an mRNA technology that was untrialed, untested, and they were trying to farm this out. Now, I'm not a conspiracy theorist than anybody else. I'm pretty pragmatic. I'm straight down the line on most things. I'm quite moderate in my views. But there was something about this that deeply, deeply concerned me. And most of my extended family have taken these vaccines. I personally wouldn't and never would, and would encourage those that haven't taken it to stand your ground, because the amount of excess deaths that we're seeing, James, is very, very deeply concerning. There's a 60% increase in excess deaths according to the Australian Bureau of Statistics. This is now impacting in the UK. Indeed, there are now 30 countries that are supporting serious amounts of excess deaths. And of course, sudden deaths within very young people, fit and healthy. We've seen them collapsing on the playing fields, the sports grounds. Very, very concerning. So the impact of the lockdowns, the impact of the pandemic, just to try to answer your question, was it wasn't too impactful from my point of view, but it still impacted everything. And I don't think there's a single person that it didn't impact. And I'm just very concerned, though, that we're still seeing these sort of campaigns by the government to roll out mRNA technology. And I'm very deeply worried about what the effects of that are going to be. And I don't want to go back to too much to Andrew Bridgen, but he was right to stand up and speak out for what he did. And I'm just appalled that not enough people in government supported him in doing that.
Yeah, I was looking at, because of course in the UK now, the government has announced that it's going to withdraw the vaccines for the under 50s. And I was looking at their statement on this, and they gave some statistics. And I was really interested in one of those. And that is the number of people that the government estimate you need to give the vaccine to between the ages of 40 and 49 years old in order to prevent one hospitalization. It's 92,500 people. So you need to give these vaccines to 92,500 40 to 49 year olds to prevent one hospitalization. That's not a death, to prevent one hospitalization. Now, if you look at other government statistics on the vaccines themselves, the government will admit and give figures and estimates on the rates of things like Bowles palsy, myocarditis, and many other things that you can get from the vaccines. And the rate for them is much, much higher than the rate in terms of the number of people you need to give it to prevent one hospitalization. I just think the UK government has really not communicated this to the British public. I don't believe there's been informed consent. And that's another reason, I hate to go back to Reform UK, why I cannot support them, because they've got a policy at the moment of everybody's got a free choice. Well, that's all very well, but when you're giving this to children and you're also withholding informed consent and not telling the population, I don't think that earns anybody's vote. Right, Jim, so what do you make of what's going on at the moment with all of this inflation and the economy? We've got about a minute and a half left. Sorry to you to pack it all into that, but if you can just give me a quick summary of what your thoughts are.
Well, I very much agreed with the previous speaker, Ben Habib, and when he was talking about the fact that cutting taxes is argued to be inflationary. It absolutely isn't. I totally agree with him on that point. The country is in such a state, James, and I know I haven't got long to try and fix it. Not that I ever really could. But the point is, what we need to do, and I think this goes back to everything that we've been saying here this morning, we've got to look at ways to break the stronghold that the Conservatives and Labour have on all of us. And unfortunately, I cannot possibly support Reform UK when it's being led by somebody that has that position about wanting to mandate vaccines, where he has said this for care workers, for example, and that people shouldn't be able to fly unless they had it. I know that was an older video, but nevertheless, I think we've got to get proper leadership going here. The way to do that, and by the way, I have been contacted by a number of political parties still in the UK, and they've been in private communications. So I'm encouraging them to look at ways to work together. And hopefully Reform will realise that this is the only real way that we're going to make real effective political change for all the reasons that we've been discussing.
Brilliant. Thank you very much, Jim Ferguson. Thank you for coming on the show and talking so much sense with me today. Right. Okay. Tomorrow I've got another great show for you. I've got two fantastic guests. I've got Shabnam Mohammed, who's from the World Council for Health and Children's Health Defence, and I've also got Counterspin Media from New Zealand. My name's James Freeman, and this is the Freeman Report on TNT Radio.